content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the December 23rd, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I'll read excerpts from Peter Sheldahl's Meditation on Living with Terminal Cancer and a profile of Mayor Pete Buttigieg. I'll begin today with a short essay from the Talk of the Town section, The Pictures Department, Truth and Make-Believe, by Michael Shulman. It was, truth be told, a miserable day in the neighborhood. Gray skies, sheets of rain, but the director, Marielle Heller, was willing to go out. Like Fred Rogers, the subject of her new film, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks, she wore a comfy sweater, although she made no ceremony of changing into her outdoor shoes. The neighborhood was Carroll Gardens, where Heller lives in a brownstone with her husband, the comedian and director Yorma Taccone, and their five-year-old Wiley. To prep for the film, Heller watched hours of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood with Wiley. He likes the parts when Mr. Rogers is in his house, and he didn't like when he goes to the land of make-believe, which is how I remember feeling. I was scared of some of the puppets, Lady Elaine particularly. Had living with Mr. Rogers in her head made her nicer? Well, it's not just being nice, she clarified. It's being honest. There's this idea that he's just kind and nice no matter what. But he was challenging to the people around him, almost aggressively intimate. When Wiley was three, Heller showed him a 1970 episode in which Rogers buries his pet goldfish and explains death, sharing a story about losing his childhood dog. Wiley looked at me like, "Dogs don't die," Heller recalled, and I was thinking about Mr. Rogers. You tell the kids the truth, but you let them lead it. And I said, well, dogs do die, and cats die. And he went, what? Cats die? But we have great cats. She showed him a photo of a previous cat she had buried in the backyard. I said, I like to believe that if I miss him, I can go visit him. He kept watching the show, and then a few minutes later he turned to me, with tears growing in his eyes, and he said, do walruses die? It wasn't until bedtime that night when Wiley asked whether people die, and when Heller told him the truth, he was inconsolable. At the time, she was going through a cancer scare and had just had thyroid surgery. A few weeks later, we went to Pittsburgh for the first time, Mr. Rogers' real-life neighborhood, and he asked me about my surgery in ways he had never asked me before. He asked if they had taken up my head off. He'd been thinking about that for a month. It was obviously what Mr. Rogers knew could happen. But he also knew that what was important was for us to be present with our kids and their dark feelings. And now, from the personal history section of the New Yorker magazine, I'll read excerpts from 77 Sunset Me, Notes on an Ending, by Peter Sheldahl. Lung cancer, rampant. No surprise. I've smoked since I was 16 behind the high school football bleachers in Northfield, Minnesota. I used to fear the embarrassment of dying youngish, letting people natter sagely. He smoked, you know. But at 77, I'm into the actuarial zone. I know about ending a dependency. I'm an alcoholic, 27 years sober. Drink was destroying my life. Tobacco only shortens it, with the best parts over anyway. I got the preliminary word from my doctor by phone while driving alone upstate from the city to join my wife, Brooke, at our country place. After the call, I found myself overwhelmed by the beauty of the passing late August land. At mile 81 of the New York State Thruway, the gray silhouettes of the Catskills came into view, perfectly framed and proportioned. How many times had I seen and loved the sight? How many more times would I? I thought of Thomas Cole's paintings from another angle of those very old, worn mountains, brooding on something until the extinction of matter. Patsy Cline was playing on the car radio, Walking After Midnight. Not a great song, but performed in Cline's way of attending selflessly to the sounds and the senses of the words, showing how art should be done. She was 30 when she died in a plane crash. Consummate. Death is like painting rather than like sculpture, because it's seen from only one side, monochrome, like the mausoleum gray former Berlin Wall, which kids in West Berlin glamorized with graffiti. What I'm trying to do here. Swatted a fly the other day and thought, outlived you. My daughter Ada was present when my oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering gave me 6 months or so to live. Ada asked me what I wanted to do. Revisit Rome? Paris? I would forget that I said, nah, maybe a ball game. She arranged it with family and friends. Mets versus Braves at Citi Field. Glorious. Grandson Oliver caught a t-shirt from the mid-game t-shirt cannon. Odds of that? Several thousand to one. Family and friends are being wonderful to me in my sickness. I've toiled all my life in vain to like myself. Now the task has been outsourced. I can't go around telling everybody they're idiots. I've always said that when my time came, I wanted to go fast. But where's the fun in that? True story. A friend received a preliminary diagnosis suggesting advanced breast cancer. Normally shy, she took this as license to tell or show everyone in her circle how little she liked or respected them. False alarm, it was cat-scratch fever. She moved overseas. When a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully, per Samuel Johnson. Why isn't Sheldahl's copy in? He's dead. Okay then. The best excuse. The most delicious poem about someone dying is Alden's In Memory of W.B. Yeats, 1939. With these lines. But for him, it was his last afternoon as himself, an afternoon of nurses and rumors. The provinces of his body revolted. The squares of his mind were empty. Silence invaded the suburbs. The current of his feeling failed. He became his admirers. The poet Ron Padgett pointed out to me the technical shrewdness of the compound last line, the all-time best use of a semicolon in place of a line break. Then there's the sterling became. Nothing is left out of Yeats, but others' thoughts of him, and the thoughts of him enhance the others like badges. We wear as many such badges as there are dead people we admire. The Shakespeare badge, the Jesus one, though he cheated on Easter morning. At what hour did the Savior reopen his eyes? At dawn? Before it, with time to kill? Seeing Hans Holbein's Dead Christ shook Dostoevsky's Christian belief, a 2 days gone corpse in a warm climate, a thing? Simon Veil said that the transcendent meaning of Christianity is complete with Jesus' death, sans the cherry on top that is the resurrection. I think so. I believe in God is a false statement for me because it is voiced by my ego, which is compulsively skeptical. But the rest of me tends otherwise, staying on an as-if basis with God, for short, hugely improves my life. I regret my lack of the church and its gift of community. My ego is too fat to squeeze through the door. Disbelieving is toilsome. It can be a pleasure for adolescent brains with energy to spare, but hanging on to it later saps and rigidifies. After a Lutheran upbringing, I became an atheist at the onset of puberty. That wore off gradually, and then, with sobriety, speedily. I had a moment while anticipating my diagnosis of feeling special. But what's as commonplace as dying? Everybody does it. I also had an instant of fancying that I could drink again. That evanesced in a flash. Fellow alcoholics know that the beast, though out of mind, survives. My thought was a foul little burp from a cave. Life doesn't go on. It goes nowhere except away. Death goes on. Going on is what death does for a living. The secret to surviving in the universe is to be dead. Self-knowledge, almost better never than late. I don't mean that at all, but I enjoy the sound of it. I am endeavoring to practice self-forgiveness. I believe it's recommended. As for folks out there in resentful and envious circles who will be glad to have me out of the way, they, by their pleasure, afford me a bonus credit for increasing human happiness. Everyone, it seems, loves Peter Sheldahl, an art website opined recently. I know for dead sure that's not so. To the extent that it's plausible, hyperbole, and because I believe in a balanced universe, the people who hate me do so with enough intensity to square up the sums. I think of righteous non-smokers in the hospital dying of nothing. That's a line for a role that Brooke played as a chain-smoking coroner in a not-great movie, Just Cause, with the great Sean Connery, who may or may not have had a say in cutting the line from the released film because it stole the scene. Soon after that, she proved her ability, which I've lacked, to break habits by quitting both smoking and acting. Her subsequent enterprises have ranged from an antiques and whatnot store, Brooks Variety, to a spectacularly unusual mini golf course on land that we own in the Catskills. Nicotine stimulates and relaxes. Beat that. I understand that it teaches the brain to prefer it to a natural neurotransmitter, acetylcholine, which, among other boons, promotes mental agility. Nicotine does the same, better. How many quitters never miss smoking? Liars line up on the left. The times I tried to stop, I wondered what writers do. Bury me. Next to cremation, I want an address that people know they can visit even if they never do. Fooey to dust on a random sea breeze or strewn on a field of unoffending vegetation. Or in a jar? Think about it. Though cemeteries waste real estate, better a Walmart parking lot? Really, do as you please with the corpse, not me, not mine. I believe in earnestly agreeing to deathbed wishes and then forgetting about them, unless it's to satisfy those among the living. Between bulletins from my body that say this isn't so, I still feel like a kid inside. 4.5 years ago, while rushing to catch a bus, don't run for a bus was a rule for longevity in Mel Brooks' 2,000-year-old man, I tripped trying to leap gazelle-like over a chunk of broken asphalt and must have caught a toe. When I came to on the street, surrounded by strangers, I had no memory of falling or of much else. Who was I? Where was I? There was blood. My glasses were smashed, and I said, "I'm okay." The strangers strenuously disagreed. An ambulance had arrived. I was mostly conscious when wheeled on a gurney into an emergency room in Greenwich Village. A scrawny, old-time village hipster type was driving the nurses crazy about something, like trying to wheedle drugs. Strolling past and glancing down at me, he said tenderly, "Die, baby." That didn't seem like a terrible idea right then, and it struck me in a remote sort of way as the funniest thing I had ever heard. A CAT scan to check out a suspicion that my neck was broken. Weird story short, my neck was found to have broken and healed sometime in the past, unbeknownst to me. incidentally discovered a spot in my left lung. This later led to hospital visits for scans and tests, including a needle biopsy. Ouch. All of them inconclusive. Fed up with the rigmarole, I refused further investigation. Shouldn't have. Live and learn. Shakespeare wrote of desiring this man's art and that man's scope. I find this comforting. But who was he thinking of? Marlowe? Someone forgotten, although evidently effing incredible? Originality is overrated, except by people who have it. It's like an untamed, ungrateful beast you're trapped with. If people praising you knew the half of it, they'd think twice. I think of Lee Crabtree, my friend who committed suicide, and of all suicides. What happens? One night in the early 70s, I perched on a tenement roof edge despite my fear of heights, legs dangling, and ordered myself to let go. It was amid a love disaster. I truly thought I'd jump, but something inside me laughed derisively. Who was I kidding? Humiliated, I went downstairs. Some, in a crisis, must lack the laugh or muffle it for long enough. Twice, I've been to Oaxaca during the Day of the Dead, when the departed members of families have their favorite food, drinks, and perhaps cigarettes set out for them at meals. It's understood that, at the table, the dead consume the immaterial goodness of these things. The families visit them overnight in graveyards. I was deeply moved by the implication that death may be a major life event, such as birth, confirmation, and marriage, but that it doesn't mean you're gone. We spare the dead a bit of the life in us. I shuddered suddenly during my second walk among placid candlelit groups. It hit me that the dead were reciprocating a bit of the death in them for us. Never fully dead, never fully alive. I may have this wrong, but I'm savoring the idea. Today, the little bit of death in me has sat up in bed and is pulling on its socks. I remember arriving in an Italian village by train after midnight and walking past a cemetery where candles burned at every grave with no one around. Or I think I remember it. We have lousy memories. Proust had a lousy memory. There is no little patch of yellow wall in Vermeer's View of Delft. Memory is a liar. It's a heap of dog-eared, smudged, incessantly revised fictions. The stories make cumulative lies or, give us a break, conjectures of our lives. This is okay because it had darn well better be. Who's we? You know? Meaning is a scrap among other scraps, though stickier. Meaning is so much better than nothing in that it defines nothing as everything that meaning is not. Meaning prevents nothing from being only nothing. The nothing that is not there and the nothing that is, Wallace Stevens noticed. The same nothing, but a difference of attitude. My daughter Ada has told me that in her childhood, she spent years trying to interest me. I hadn't noticed. She was 16 when I got sober. She said, "Let's see if I get this straight. Now you want to be my dad." It took a lot of time and change, and is still underway. I don't know if it's a consolation prize for Ada, or what it is, that she turned out to be fantastically interesting. Meeting Brooke, having Ada, and getting sober are my life's top three red-letter days. Cigarette brands I remember smoking for at least a few months running include Alpine, Salem, Newport, Camel, Lucky Strike, Parliament, Kent, Galosi's, Benson and Hedges, Nat Sherman. Finally, and I do mean finally, Marlboro Gold, formerly Lights. The crack cocaine of tobacco products containing all sorts of cunning chemicals and a somewhat insulting whisper of sugar. Doing the math, I reckon that I have smoked about a million cigarettes and enjoyed every one of them, not that you care. Tried gum, patches, and e-cigarettes, not the same. I use nicotine lozenges to not be twitchy on airplanes, while driving with family, and indoors anywhere except in my offices in our city apartment and country house with exhaust fans in open windows, challenging during summer heat and winter cold. Smoking today requires grit. Quit now? Sure, and have the rest of my life be a tragic comedy of nicotine withdrawal? I'm not in physical pain as I write, though I tire quickly and nap often. I have been receiving, every 3 weeks, an immunotherapy infusion, not chemo, not a cure, which at the outset the doctor said had a 35% chance of slowing the disease. At those odds in Vegas, you're broke within an hour, but in baseball, you're a cinch for the Hall of Fame. A recent scan shows marked improvement, likely extending my prospect of survival. But I have to wonder if, whatever betides, I can stay upbeat in spirit. A thing about dying is that you can't consult anyone who has done it. No rehearsals, no mulligans. Oddly or not, I find myself thinking about death less than I used to. I thought that I might be kidding myself in my explorations of the subject while my life stretched ahead of me into an invisible horizon. But no. The thinking cut channels in which I now slip along. They involve acceptance. Why me? Why not me? In point of fact, me. Dying is my turn to survey life from its far, now near shore. These extra months are a luxury that I hope to have put to good use. To have put, see? While here, not here. Like a camera situated nowhere and taking in every last detail of the pulsating world. God creeps in. Human minds are the universe's only instruments for reflecting on itself. The fact of our existence suggests a cosmic approval of it. Do we behave badly? We are gifted with the capacity to think so. We may be accidents of matter and energy, but we can't help circling back to the sense of a meaning that is unaccountable by the application of what we know. If God is a human invention, good for us. We had to come up with something. Take death for a walk in your minds, folks. Either you'll be glad you did, or, keeling over suddenly, you won't be out anything. And now, from the political scene, high hopes. Pete Buttigieg wants to win over disaffected Republicans. But can he unite Democrats? By Benjamin Wallace Wells. By November, Iowa and New Hampshire began to feel as cold as they will in February, when the first votes in the presidential race will be cast there. On November 10th, in Berlin, New Hampshire, the sun set at 4:22 p.m. In Littleton, on the far side of the White Mountains, there was a crust of snow on the ground. Among Democratic campaigns and voters, the carnival pageantry of the summer, of state fairs and parades, gave way to an intense theater of hope, winnowing, and dread. More than a dozen candidates were competing for the nomination, but none had convincingly demonstrated that he or she could build a strong Democratic coalition, let alone defeat Donald Trump. Joe Biden, who as Barack Obama's vice president was his most natural successor and who is still first in the national polls, had been campaigning languidly, with periodic outbursts of worrying verbiage, and his standing had deteriorated throughout the year. Bernie Sanders had been off the trail for 2 weeks in October following a heart attack. Elizabeth Warren, who had gathered strong support with her message about the quiet desperation of the middle class, now seemed to be confusing more voters than she was attracting by insisting on her plan to dispense with private insurance and replace it at a cost of more than $20 trillion with Medicare for All. This fall, as even the prospect of impeachment seemingly did little to erode Donald Trump's base, Democrats began to notice the void at the center of American politics, and to wonder, with increasing urgency, who might fill it. When over Veterans Day weekend, Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, a gay married man and a military veteran, with a calm, slightly abstracted manner, boarded his campaign bus for a tour of New Hampshire. He still seemed like a niche candidate, polling in the low teens in the state. He was mostly popular with white professionals and showed a distinct talent for fundraising, bringing in more money than any other Democratic candidate in the second quarter of 2019. By Thanksgiving, the race had shifted. Buttigieg was leading by several points in both Iowa and New Hampshire, and he was up to second in a national Quinnipiac poll, which noted that he had become the favored candidate of white voters without college educations, too. The surface absurdity of this situation, that one of the leading candidates for the job of rescuing a free nation from a corrupt would-be authoritarian is a mayor who has never won more than 11,000 votes in an election, is generally unacknowledged on the campaign trail these days. Buttigieg is 37, just 2 years clear of the constitutional minimum for a president. He is small and slight, with thick, dark hair, peaked eyebrows, pale skin, and a quiet, anticipatory presence. He is often on the balls of his feet. In New Hampshire, Buttigieg wore a white shirt and a blue tie under an oversized brown leather bomber jacket that looked as if it had been purchased in haste when the cold descended. He followed the pilgrimage trail of a Democrat in a rural state, craft brewery to solar array, craft brewery to solar array, in an unassuming way. He's not an especially physical or energetic performer on the stump. His great gift is his voice, which is deep and relaxed. He often stands with his left shoulder a little slouched and lets a baritone reasonableness suffuse the room. His punchlines sound like observations. I don't have to throw myself a military parade to see what a convoy looks like, because I was driving one around Afghanistan right about this time, the time that this president was taping season 7 of The Celebrity Apprentice. Voters who come to Buttigieg events tend to know two things about him. The first is that he was something of a boy wonder, an ace literature student at Harvard and a Rhodes Scholar. On the trail, Buttigieg wears his intelligence lightly but insistently. He does not use bookish words or delve deeply into policy detail, but early in the race, at the request of an Oslo camera crew, he did speak some words of Norwegian, a language he said he had taught himself in order to read the untranslated work of the novelist Erlend Loe. And when an exchange student from Gaza posed a question about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, he replied briefly in Arabic. Of all the aspects of Buttigieg's persona, the boy wonder thing is what has most seduced his fans and irritated his opponents, who see it as a way of turning a very fast and self-conscious rise through the establishment into a story of destiny. At the fifth Democratic debate in November, Cory Booker, a senator from New Jersey who was a two-term mayor of Newark, pointed out that he too was a Rhodes Scholar and that he had served as mayor of the largest city in my state. South Bend, with a population of 101,000, is the fourth largest city in Indiana, right behind Evansville. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, who was running toward the bottom of the pack, was characteristically blunt about the modesty of her rival's current office. Women are held to a higher standard, she said. The second thing that voters knew about Buttigieg is more meaningful, that he hopes to embody what one of his senior strategists described to me as the yearning for reconciliation. Waiting to hear Buttigieg speak at the refurbished Rex Theater in Manchester, New Hampshire, Dan Chase, 56, told me, I'll be honest with you, I voted for Trump, and I'm embarrassed about it. But if the president embarrassed him, Sanders and Warren spooked him. They are way out there. Standing next to Chase was Mary Kate Rauke, 23, who had favored Warren until she heard the details of Warren's Medicare for All plan, which seemed, she said, dubiously super ambitious. On stage, Buttigieg said that the coming years would require a president who can stand on the rubble of what has been busted in our society and in our politics, pick up the pieces, implement bold solutions, get something done about those issues, and he leaned hard on the word, find a way to do it that's actually going to unify the American people. The good news I'm offering you is that it can happen. That will happen when I'm your president. There was a round of applause. Watch Buttigieg long enough and you notice that he uses abstraction as an escape hatch. Above the quotidian divisions of politics, he describes a realm up where all Americans are one. His campaign has failed dismally to attract African-American voters. According to one recent poll, his support among black Democrats in South Carolina is at less than 1%. So I ask him what themes helped him make a connection with them. A really big one is faith, he said. What common ground could he offer Republicans given his progressive policy ideas? I think appealing to family and family values is really important to me, he replied. It was like watching a pilot, once all normal systems had failed, push the button on an ejector seat. These appeals to old-fashioned American values are his most politician-like habit, and they give his language a touch of nostalgia. As Buttigieg began rising in the polls, his staff invited groups of reporters onto the campaign bus for a rolling, on-the-record conversation that lasted one Sunday for more than 4.5 hours. The idea had been championed by Liz Smith, Buttigieg's communications director, who is a year younger than he, but is a veteran of New York politics and of Obama's 2012 campaign. On the bus, Smith was an antic, profane presence. "You ingrates," she mocked, howled at us when she realized that no reporter had thanked her for all the access. When I asked Smith if the tour had been modeled on John McCain's Straight Talk Express of 2000, she replied, "Obvi," but Buttigieg is a less chummy presence than McCain. "He'll tease the press," David Foster Wallace wrote of McCain on the trail in 2000, "and give them crap in a way that they don't ever mind, because it's the sort of crap that makes you feel that here's this very, very cool, important guy who's noticing you and liking you enough to give you crap." Buttigieg gave no one crap. Everyone grew slightly more formal in his presence. He settled into a seat, steepled his fingers, and waited. It took a little time for the conversation to focus. Buttigieg can give a thoughtful answer to almost any question, but he rarely tells a joke or heartfelt accounts of the people he meets on the trail. He doesn't gossip. When reporters ask him to comment about a development of the day, he says something generic or just backs away from it. He's far more interested in the broad sweep of social experience and political history. Eventually, I asked him to explain why so many Democrats want big structural change, in Warren's phrasing, or a political revolution, in Sanders. As Buttigieg told it, the story began in his childhood with Ronald Reagan's administration and stretched through the Obama years, a decades-long period that he described as the Reagan era, a time of neoliberal consensus around pre-market capitalism and of escalating inequality. A lot of it is Trump, but I think it's really a reaction to 40 years of dismantling social democracy, Buttigieg said. We're reaping the consequences of them hollowing out so many of these things, and sometimes that expresses itself in very perverse ways, like it helps lead to Trump, who's going to make it worse. Obama, he noted, ushered in a major financial and health care reforms, but in a matter of months he was hamstrung by a Republican Senate majority that was obsessed with conservative fiscal policy and refused to work with the White House. "We saw real progress, but it was constrained," Buttigieg said. "But I do think it's true that we didn't fully anticipate the bad faith of Mitch McConnell's Senate." His voice rose to a more speculative tone. He thought the problem was partly that the George W. Bush years had been characterized by zealotry, which is different from cynicism. In other words, you had, especially with the neocons, these true believers kind of fanatically pulling us in a direction that I think was terrible, but there's a sense that was what they truly believed. With Trump and with McConnell, Buttigieg said, there's so little good faith that it's just different than a strong contest of ideas. He had worked himself around to one of the central tensions of his candidacy: how a politics of unity could work at a time of extreme partisanship. Buttigieg's theory seems to be that change will take place on two tracks. He has proposed radical reforms to the political system, abolishing the Electoral College in favor of a national popular vote, and changing the composition of the Supreme Court. For the court, he has suggested giving 5 seats to each party and creating 5 more seats for federal judges who would rotate through on 1-year appointments. I believe I have an obligation to start building the case for that, even if it won't arrive for quite a while, he said. In the meantime, he plans to pursue a more pragmatic agenda based on public support for gun law reform, action on climate change, and heavier taxation of the very wealthy. He sometimes says that as president, he would often fly to red states to pressure recalcitrant members of Congress. On the bus, someone asked him if that would actually work. Well, even compared to the last time we had a Democratic president, people have moved in our direction on the issues, Buttigieg said, and there's been zero extent to which that's been tracked by a movement among Republicans in Congress. So I do think that showing up in areas where you can create pressure, even in areas where you're going to be unpopular, it's going to be really important for combating polarization as well as for getting an agenda through. If you squinted, you could start to see the outlines of a Buttigieg presidency: uplifting talk about generational change and an incrementalist approach to policy. At each stop in New Hampshire, a few reporters got off the bus and a few others got on, and there would be another round of newsy questions. Eventually, the deeper topics would be picked up again. Buttigieg answered everything in the same ultra-thoughtful tone, so that we went down a few rabbit holes. At one point, he tried to recall exactly how he had responded to a bully who shoved him when he was 13 or 14. When Buttigieg whirled around to confront him, had he hit the kid or just stared him down? A presidential summit-level intensity set in. Asked which hymn he liked best, Buttigieg named one that he'd learned in Welsh, and then was embarrassed that he couldn't remember the words in English. The conversation moved on. Chicken wings were distributed. Someone cracked open a White Claw hard seltzer. And as we headed over the White Mountains, a young CNN reporter tentatively referred to the healing that the candidate said that he has been seeing underway in the country. Buttigieg's husband, Chasten Buttigieg, a 30-year-old school teacher, comes from a conservative Michigan family that struggled at first with Chasten's sexuality. But now, Buttigieg had been saying on the stump, Chasten's parents had embraced the couple and the candidate planned to go deer hunting on Thanksgiving morning with his father-in-law. Have you spoken to Chasten's brother lately? The reporter asked. He was referring to Ryan Glesman, a born-again Christian pastor who has appeared on Laura Ingraham's show and who told the Washington Post, I just don't support the gay lifestyle. Would he be coming to Thanksgiving dinner? Many politicians, when asked a delicate question, pause as they weigh what they want to say, and the sympathies their answers might provoke, and then the antagonisms. Well, they begin, and then they inhale, and we wait. Buffering, the MSNBC host Chris Hayes recently called it, referring to Obama, who does it often. Buttigieg did it now. Eventually, he said, I think that part of my Thanksgiving will stay off the record. The bus went quiet, and he sat there a little stiffly, no longer so pure an embodiment of the yearning for reconciliation. Pete Buttigieg was born in South Bend in 1982, the son of 2 Notre Dame professors, Joseph Buttigieg, a Maltese immigrant and a scholar and translator of the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, and Anne Montgomery, an Indiana native and linguist. Buttigieg notes in his elegant campaign memoir, Shortest Way Home, that the central trauma of South Bend, the closure of the Studebaker plant, which resulted in the loss of 7,000 jobs, occurred in the 60s, decades before he was born. Growing up in any place with a lost golden age, you absorb its legacy in fragments, hearing once great names, Oliver, Morris, Bendix, Studebaker, without being able to match them to anything living, he writes. You take them in at first without comprehension, like the names of the saints. His family stayed in South Bend proper, near Notre Dame, even as many white families moved to the suburbs, and he was intensely aware of the deterioration of downtown. You no longer went to get your first communion soup from Gilbert's or Robertson's downtown anymore. Instead, you went to JCPenney at the mall in nearby Mishawaka. Deindustrialization had more severe effects in South Bend than the occasional trip to Mishawaka. In 2011, black poverty spiked to 53%. But Buttigieg says little in the book about the African-American experience. He recently acknowledged that as mayor, he was slow to realize that in part because of white flight, the public schools in his county were effectively segregated. In 2004, Buttigieg graduated from Harvard, where he was the student president of the Institute of Politics, a nonpartisan center founded in honor of John F. Kennedy. For a young political hopeful, it was a heady but circumscribed time. Democrats seemed desperately in need of big ideas, but the center of the country was still understood to be pretty conservative. Buttigieg started a group with some college friends, the Democratic Renaissance Project, whose members read up on John Dewey, Louis Brandeis, and other liberal intellectual icons, and tried to imagine how Democrats might reclaim the initiative. K. Sabir Rahman, a member of the Renaissance Project, who is now a professor at Brooklyn Law School and the president of the liberal think tank Demos, told me, "There seem to be all these crises, the Iraq War, the Bush tax cuts, the sanctioning of torture, and yet it felt like conservative ideas were ascendant and progressive ones kept losing. In part because we kept moderating ourselves and stayed within the bounds of a generally conservative worldview." Obama's election in 2008 provoked hope and then some anxiety in Buttigieg's circle, Rahman said. There was a sense that the infrastructure of progressive ideas was not set up yet, that Obama had arrived after 30 years of Reaganism, while FDR had followed 30 years of progressive agitation. Buttigieg pursued his interest in political theory as a Rhodes Scholar studying in the Philosophy, Politics, and Economics program at Oxford. He also wanted an education in the real world, if there was such a thing, he writes. This led him to a 2.5-year stint at the Chicago office of McKinsey & Company, the prestigious American consulting firm known for its discreet counsel to the world's most powerful governments and corporations. It was a deeply conventional choice for an ambitious Harvard graduate, and Buttigieg has struggled to explain it to progressives. McKinsey's reputation has been badly tarnished by recent reports that it has advised state-owned companies in China and Russia and the monarchy of Saudi Arabia, and that it helped Trump's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency identify detention savings opportunities, including cuts to food and medical care for detainees. Under pressure from Elizabeth Warren and the Times editorial board, Buttigieg released a summary of his work at McKinsey and then a list of clients, which included Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, Best Buy, and the U.S. Postal Service. While working for another client, the Defense Department, in 2009, he traveled to Iraq and Afghanistan as part of an economic development project. Buttigieg moved back to South Bend in 2007 when he was 25. It was time, he writes, to seek out the things that mattered most. Contemplating how few Harvard graduates now served in the military, he signed up for the Navy Reserve and began training as an intelligence officer. It cannot have been lost on him that his service would be an asset for a political career. In 2010, Buttigieg was the Democratic nominee for Indiana's state treasurer and lost to the incumbent by more than 24 points. But 2 years later, he ran in an open mayoral race and won with nearly 74% of the vote. Buttigieg governed as a modernizer at a time when cities everywhere are modernizing. As mayor, he widened sidewalks, slowed down traffic, and used tax breaks to attract new business. The idea was that a city couldn't thrive without a heart and that meant making the downtown and the city a place where people wanted to be. Scott Ford, who helped lead the redevelopment effort, told me. By the most basic measure, Buttigieg's administration was a success. The economy improved everywhere during his tenure, but it improved a bit more in South Bend, where the unemployment rate dropped from 10% to 3.5%, and a half-century-long decline in population began to reverse. Buttigieg came out to his parents in early 2015 and to the public that summer during his re-election campaign. He went on to win with more than 80% of the vote, and he married Chasten in 2018 in an Episcopal cathedral downtown. Annie Mannix, a doyen of housing activists in South Bend, told me with some amazement about accompanying Buttigieg this year to the Westside Democratic and Civic Club's Dingus Day celebration, an all-day drinking fest in honor of Polish heritage. And here are all these old Polish guys toasting Pete and Chasten, the mayor and his husband. In South Bend, Buttigieg was keeping up the Harvard connections that would help make his high ambitions seem plausible. Through his friend Eric Lesser, who was working in the Obama administration, he met and impressed Obama's chief strategist, David Axelrod, who introduced him to Liz Smith. His friend Swati Mailavarapu, a tech founder and investor who was with him at Harvard and Oxford, is his campaign's investment chair. Another college friend reportedly introduced him to Mark Zuckerberg, with his wife Priscilla Chan recommended two people who were hired by the campaign. This past September, Buttigieg was asked to define neoliberalism on Twitter, and he replied, "Neoliberalism is the political economic consensus that has governed the last 40 years of policy in the U.S. and U.K. Its failure helped to produce the Trump moment. Now we have to replace it with something better." Neoliberalism might also be defined as the political economic consensus that allows Mark Zuckerberg to recommend campaign hires to Pete Buttigieg. Some have recently observed that Buttigieg has left behind the politics of his father, the Marxist scholar, who died early this year. He tends to emphasize his father's less ideological work on James Joyce. Centrist child syndrome, the writer Shuja Hyder called it on the website The Outline. Buttigieg told me that his father had left a subtler imprint on him. He was somebody who was important with some of the self-indulgence that had happened in the humanities as it drifted away from a connection to reality. He was somebody who was impatient with some of the self-indulgence that had happened in the humanities as it drifted away from a connection to reality, he said. One of the books he loved was Edmund Wilson's To the Finland Station, right? Where you start off with, I think it's Herder figuring out Vico, the German philosopher Johann Gottfried Herder, and the Italian philosopher Giambattista Vico, and by the And you've got Lenin showing up. The point is that you see how something that starts out really esoteric and academic ends up changing history. He thought about it a little more, but also there were times where I would just push off from it too because he was so furious with what the right has done that you could spoil the taste of a wine for him by telling him it came from a white ring vineyard. Buttigieg smiled. He was so deep in it. Buttigieg is often charged with being too young or too inexperienced for the presidency. In fact, his candidacy poses a slightly different problem. He has not yet fully formed his political identity, and, as a presidential candidate, he is immature. When he was asked on the bus in New Hampshire about his experience, Buttigieg mentioned that he had bought a house before he'd held down a steady job and had gone to war before I had my first experience being in love. He said, "I guess I'm comfortable doing things in a way that's kind of out of order." Buttigieg's increasing strength is not yet the story of the Democratic primary, but it has been an unexpected element, and it suggests that the calculations of the amateurs in a time of stress may not be so different from those of the pros. They favor a candidate with appeal to white swing voters over one who can draw out the African-American base and for polish over populist fervor. And yet, as Buttigieg fairly noted, The race has hardly begun. I suspect January will be its own whole other level, he said. We were riding in a black SUV headed west through Iowa at dusk on the Monday before Thanksgiving. I think that these voters who still haven't really dialed in will start paying attention. The folks who are just too busy, too overwhelmed with the sheer number of candidates will get into this, he said. It had been a well-planned day of campaigning with four events leading up to a big evening rally in Council Bluffs. On Twitter, Buttigieg campaign volunteers were being mocked for videos of a dance they had choreographed to his campaign song, High Hopes, whose aroma of corporate marketing was made only more pungent by the fact that some of the videos showed high-energy young people teaching the dance to earnest older volunteers. In Red Oak, Iowa, in the morning, there had been a community forum on long-term care. Buttigieg took notes while local practitioners gave a dire view of old age in rural America. Next was a stately lunchtime town hall for about 300 people in Creston. At the end, a teenager whose best friend had killed herself earlier in the year asked about mental health resources for schools. That allowed Buttigieg to take up a pretty natural role as a sort of guidance counselor. Sometimes we don't talk about something like that, and we have to, he said. During the day, three people had told Buttigieg that they were Republicans, active or former, who were considering his candidacy. In the SUV, he said to me, "You can tell a lot of Republicans are ready to cross over. Didn't suddenly become liberal. They just feel that exhaustion from fighting. Which is why we've got to make sure that our answer is not some kind of equal and opposite meanness." Buttigieg posited that the economic alienation that was central to the 2016 presidential election was now matched by a powerful political alienation, a sense, he said, that has people feeling like elections aren't fair and having reason to feel that way when they see how districts are drawn, for example. I think it's that question of how some politics can command so much support and get nowhere. Buttigieg often paused after a question, repeated some element of it that interested or puzzled him, stared off into space, and then answered. Even when he landed on talking points, these pauses allowed him to hint that he had considered a more original response. Buffering. Of course, 1 year into a presidential campaign, his talking points inundated every conversational inlet. When I asked him about the High Hopes dance, he answered in the weirdly stentorian cadence of a movie trailer voiceover. In an age of exclusion and amid a crisis of belonging, I actually believe that there's a certain amount of moral lift to be found in goofy joy. It was dark enough outside the SUV that we could not see past the road, creating a serene atmosphere inside. The four campaign aides traveling with us were quiet, perhaps in deference to the general demeanor of a politician whose way to relax on the road is, as he pointed out later that evening, to play board games with his husband. He recommended Risk. I asked about an aspect of his pitch that had always been opaque to me. If Trump was the president who ended the Reagan era, then what exactly was the era that would follow, the one he was campaigning to begin? "Well, as you know, I'm skeptical of nostalgia," he said, making me wonder why he thought I knew that. "But a non-trivial part of what we've got to do is establish a kind of social democracy like we had pre-Reagan. The difference is, I think, that there has to be a lot more attention to our democratic structures and systems, because we see how they have been manipulated for the purposes of frustrating a majority." He was alluding to his plans for the Supreme Court and the Electoral College. "I think there needs to be an emphasis on political reform, the likes of which we probably haven't seen since the first progressive era." He mentioned a familiar trope, that there is a new American majority for ideas that a few years ago would have been considered too liberal for the mainstream, for broad action on guns and climate change, for much steeper taxation of the rich, and for expanded health care. Warren and Sanders have built their campaigns around these issues, arguing that the main obstacle to progressive policies is the billionaire class, who they say must pay for those policies through new wealth taxes and higher estate taxes. Buttigieg is not ideologically committed to developing a new welfare program. He favors expanding Medicare and college loan programs, and he seems to believe that populist agitation is unnecessary. Of the new era, he said, in many ways, it's defined by the question of what happens when a minority becomes a majority. I asked whether he meant a demographic minority. Yes, he said, but also a political minority. Unlike many Democrats, Buttigieg suggests that the traumas of the past decade are as much political as economic. What gives his campaign its peculiar mood of optimism in the midst of an emergency is his conviction that a progressive consensus is already present in the country, and that the way to spoil it is to be too partisan or unwelcoming, that the change has already come. We bundled out of the SUV into the gymnasium of Abraham Lincoln High School in Council Bluffs. A huge American flag was stretched across the back of the stage. Chairs had been set up in half the gym. Those filled, and then more, doors opened, and a crowd poured into the other half of the gym and a small balcony above. There were 2,100 people, and when a microphone malfunctioned during the warm-up speeches, they broke into a coordinated chant. I-O-W-A, Mayor Pete is all the way. I-O-W-A, Mayor Pete, all the way. On stage, Buttigieg was looser. The left shoulder slouched lower, more casually, and he occasionally broke into a toothy grin. The stump speech, usually a tightly wound 12 minutes, unfurled past 15. The jokes were the same, but he gave them an extra beat. The mood in the gym was a little giddy. Buttigieg welcomed future former Republicans and urged them to join our movement, a phrase that I hadn't heard from him before. It was a somewhat surprising term for such a middle-of-the-road campaign, but it carried Buttigieg's unusual note of dissent, his notion that, despite the populist tide, Democrats might still prefer a presidential candidate who looks a lot like the ones they've chosen in the past. The previous article was edited for length. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.